Media shouldn't be one note. Support Rabble.ca and a diversity of voices in Canadian media. Visit rabble.ca/donate to contribute.
This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and what's next. It's a show that asks questions and peels back the layers of our average everyday experience and goes beyond scratching the surface. We interview people doing incredible things who are making a difference around the globe. Join me as we listen in and get one step closer to understanding that big ideas shared create collaboration. Collaboration can inspire community, and communities create social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face. My next interview is with Karen Doherty. She's a psychotherapist who is a psychoanalytic candidate. Maybe by the time this airs, she will in fact be a psychoanalyst. She's also, though, a filmmaker. She's a producer. She's a director. She's got an incredibly interesting past. Check her out online, her website. But more importantly right now, and look for the bio for that, but more importantly, listen in to the interview. We talk about why certainty is dangerous and why we need to be comfortable with, you know, not knowing. And this mask of happiness that we all seem to carry around with us, and this idea of the frozen smile. We talk a great deal about transgenerational trauma. It's tough to pronounce, never mind to explain, and Karen and talks about it a great deal. So listen in. I hope you enjoy it. I think you will. Lots to learn here. Karen is terrific. We had a wonderful conversation. Could have gone on much longer. Hopefully we're going to do a part two. And there's something here for everyone. So again, I hope you enjoy the interview. DavidPeckLive.com. Check out the list. We're getting close to over 150 interviews posted. Rabble.ca, also interviews hosted there. And we'll see you very soon. Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by a very special guest today, Karen Doherty. She's joining us here today. I'm actually sitting in her office. She's a psychotherapist and apparently, and we're going to ask her about this, a psychoanalytic candidate. Karen, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks.
I just want to be really clear. You made note of it, Karen. I'm sitting in the patient's chair.
You are.
You're in the therapist's chair.
I know.
So should I be concerned is my first question.
I'm not so sure about that. Maybe because I don't say a lot in this chair usually.
Right.
So
uh-huh.
Maybe we should swap chairs.
And yeah, it is interesting. Yeah, I guess you're well, you know what, one of the themes as a development guy, my listeners will know, is that we talk a lot about listening. Mm-hmm. The whole idea of stepping into another culture, cross-cultural communication, the ability to not assimilate but to be aware, is all about not saying a whole lot, right? Taking in observations, being a bit of a poet, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And just listening and watching and so on. But I hope you're not going to do that today. So I'm here to ask. And the other question, really important, is are you charging me for this?
I will not charge you for this. Are you charging me?
That's right. This is great. So we can just see this as a therapy session and we'll be fine. Okay. So you're a filmmaker. You're a producer. I've spent a little bit of time online. And by the way, folks, KarenDoherty.ca, that's DoHERTY.ca, check her practice out online. You're a filmmaker, TVO, producer, director, story editor. I mean, fascinating past. And here you are sitting in a psychotherapist chair.
Mm-hmm.
First question, though, I want to ask before we get into this. Can you make the distinction between a psychotherapist and a psychoanalytic? You say you're a candidate for that, so you're studying,
yeah.
You're about to be tested.
I am a candidate at the Toronto Institute of Psychoanalysis, and I actually did a couple of years at the Toronto Institute of Contemporary Psychoanalysis. There are two institutes in the city.
Oh, okay.
One is more sort of towards relational and psychology in terms of how it got its start, whereas the TIP, the institute I'm at now, is the old school institute. In other words, it was founded quite early on. It's internationally recognized. It's part of the International Psychoanalytic Association. So I jumped ship after 2 years at the TICP, and now I'm training as a psychoanalyst at the TIP. So the difference, you asked, between psychoanalysis and psychotherapy, there you could read books and books and books on this,
but
I'm just going to make a quick distinction and point to the couch right here. So this couch is a psychoanalytic couch. You're sitting in the chair, face-to-face psychotherapy, whereas psychoanalysis is, generally speaking, the distinction is about frequency. So at least three, but more usually four or five times a week on the couch. Right. So psychotherapy, generally speaking, once a week, twice a week.
So obviously the couch, I'm not looking at you.
That's right.
So I've heard things before that, you know, men, the reason why men golf, I mean, we're going to go all sexist and divisive here, but the reason is because, you know, you're never really looking at each other face to face. You're always in the cart, or when you fish, you're, you know, when you're driving, that's when men chat, right? Because they don't look at each other.
That's
part
funny.
Of that distinction that we're talking about? Men and women, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But I just, you know, I heard that fairly recently in a conversation.
That's funny. I hadn't thought about that because, we talked about also, I'm a filmmaker, and, you know, sometimes when you're doing a documentary and you want somebody to just riff, you'll put them in a car when they're driving, they don't have as much attention to the sensor, right?
Interesting.
So maybe that's connected somehow. But I think the idea of the couch is, yes, you're not distracted by the social niceties of the face-to-face, first of all, right? But also it's a place where we can regress, which is important in
psychoanalysis. So the idea of regress, in other words, go deeper?
Go younger.
Oh, go younger.
Yeah, regressing is sort of going back developmentally
to
a place.
So child memories, obviously I go to abuse, but those types of things, what happened when we were in formative years?
Not so much about memories, but about your state. Your emotional state. So when we sit face to face, we're more likely to kind of be adults, right?
Right.
Whereas,
You use the word niceties.
Yeah. Right. Social niceties face to face, right?
So so presumably there is a wall here between you and I right now, in a sense.
In a sense, and in a sense, it's the wall is just social. Society, right? A lot of my patients actually sitting in that chair won't, if they're really kind of doing free association, which is what we want in here, that's one of the elements of psychoanalysis, free association, right? They won't really be looking at me very much. They'll be looking somewhere else, right? Because looking is, it's actually quite stimulating.
Are the eyes the key to the soul? Is that sort of...
Well, we can talk about that when we talk about the film that I'm making.
Yes, yes.
Right?
So why, so interesting. So why the, I was going to say why the shift, but it doesn't sound like you have shifted because you're dancing in several worlds. You're filmmaking,
yes.
You're editing, you're producing, you're psychoanalyzing. Mm-hmm.
It's obviously, all of a piece.
Well, exactly.
I mean,
you know, to say that it's all connected seems almost trite and cliche in a way. But the older I'm getting, and I'm now half a century, 50 just recently. So it really is all connected for the love. I mean, I was on the phone with a philosopher yesterday doing an interview, and you know, truth is relational. And why has it taken us so long to figure that out? It's not mathematics. Mathematics is bullshit, right? On some level, right? And so Lawrence, his comment yesterday was that, well, hang on, Plato was so wrong, you know, to be suspicious of the arts, to be suspicious of, you know, victims of magic, said Plato, you know, you're being deceived. Whereas Lawrence is, after 25 years of teaching philosophy and performing and so on, he says, hang on a minute, this is where it's at, right? Not in that analytical sort of kind of tradition, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, I think in a way you're talking about uncertainty, not knowing. That's the essence of psychoanalysis, for sure. You know, like, how do we get to a place where we're just a little bit more comfortable with not knowing? Because what we don't know, really anything, and it's certainty that gets us in trouble, in the world, right? And so that's sort of mostly what I'm doing in here, is sort of being comfortable with my own uncertainty about what might be going on within someone, but also helping someone to get to a place where they're comfortable with the uncertainty of being in the world, right? Because the world's a hard place to be.
It is a hard place to be, and, you know, and yet as I, again, get older, I mean, I am seeing that crazy, beautiful world in front of me. You know, with 8 and 10-year-old kids, raising them, Elizabeth and I, you see the liabilities, but you also see the, wow, this is really quite awesome.
Yes.
Right? And I guess, so what you're saying is it's a balancing act, is it kind of?
Yeah, it is, but we're also talking about, I mean, when I'm talking about my patients, I'm talking about people who are suffering too, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Like profoundly suffering. And so Freud, you know, the father of psychoanalysis, he figured psychoanalysis for him was really about getting people who are in a state of abject misery to a place of everyday normal unhappiness.
That sounds like the opening line of my autobiography.
That's, which one?
Yeah, abject suffering. Yeah, no. We got to get from suffering to just sort of being miserable, but happily miserable.
Yeah, like being okay with how hard it is.
Yeah.
Because sometimes it's fantastic, and sort of being able to weather the storm. So that's the idea, I guess, behind psychoanalysis, at least these days.
So do you not trust people that you meet that are always happy? Happy with a small H, by the way.
Well, yeah, big H, small H. You can, qualitatively, I think you can tell when someone has their mask of happy versus someone who is sort of at rest.
Right.
Right? So I think, yeah, I know. And I would add that when you see someone with a mask of happy, what an analyst might think, and I'm not saying that I'm psychoanalyzing everybody all the time, because I'm not.
How come you're not making notes on this conversation?
You're making notes.
That's right. I want your insights when we're done here.
Over coffee.
That's right. Yes. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I do think that an analytic mind would maybe see someone with that happy face, you know, the frozen smile or the always happy, as someone who is disavowing aggression, their own aggression that they're not allowed to have.
So help me solve a problem here with my wife, Elizabeth. So what's so funny about us is, you know, so, okay, I got to tell this story, and I probably told this on the podcast before. We're driving home from Aurelia. Kids might have been in the car, not sure. We're in Holland Marsh area. Mm. I look to the left. I swear that I see a tornado cloud, a funnel cloud coming across. You know, that would be a place you might see.
Absolutely.
That, right?
Yeah.
And that's kind of an area. It's sort of the snow belt. I mean, I think it, you know, you can get some extreme weather up there from time to time. And I've certainly heard about tornadoes touching. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it actually turned out to be a rainbow. So Elizabeth, of course, was the first to notice that it was a rainbow. So, I mean, this is tornadoes and rainbows. This is kind of the dynamic.
Maybe that's the name of your autobiography.
Maybe that is the name, yes, yeah. But so Elizabeth has this ability to look on the bright side, to see things in a way that I often don't. And so I'm at the point in my life where I actually have a reminder in my BlackBerry that says more positive language. Just use more positive language, Peck, for heaven's sakes. Like, try to... So, in other words, is it about getting out of the right side of the bed in the morning? Is it about... I mean, is this about choosing to not be abjectfully miserable?
And well, I think that idea that we can just sort of choose our temperament, because you're really, what you're talking about right now is your temperament.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
That's a bit of a burden to place on ourselves, because
there's a real condition there, isn't there?
Yeah, I think, you know, temperament is different from symptom, right? So if the fact that you can only see the darkness is a symptom somehow of some unmetabolized trauma or something, then that can change. But if temperamentally you're just someone who, you know, I mean, I think there's a lot to be said for what we're born with. If temperamentally you're just someone who kind of sees things in a certain way, and in your condition just from birth to do that, then you don't want to have to put pressure on yourself to take that away.
Would you say that temperament is, I mean, again, you know, I'm not trying to dualize the conversation here or to polarize it, I suppose is a better word, but I mean, it's rarely either or, right? So temperament is going to be upbringing. It's going to be nature and nurture, is it?
Absolutely.
Not?
Absolutely. It is. Yeah. It is nature and nurture. And again, this is the film that I'm working on right now is largely looks at that. Yeah. When we're babies.
Right. This is the piece on mother-infant communication.
Yes. A documentary about the work of Dr. Beatrice Beebe, who is an infant researcher in the Department of Psychiatry at Columbia University in New York. And she's just this amazing woman who, for 40 years, has been studying mother-infant communication using video microanalysis. So what she does is she has a lab at Columbia. And she, in the lab, she'll bring in a mother and a four-month-old infant, right? It's usually a mother. Sometimes it's a father. Usually it's a mother and a four-month-old infant. And she puts them in the lab. She puts a camera on the mother and a camera on the baby. And the instructions are, interact as you would. No toys. That's all. And she records the first uninterrupted 2.5 minutes. And then she does microanalysis, so second by second or frame by frame analysis of the dyadic interaction between mother and infant. So what the mother does, and then what the baby does, and then when the baby does that, what does the mother do? So contingencies, right? It's an interaction. And from that, she can, from that 230 frames, she can predict your attachment style as a one-year-old, and of course at one, with the Ainsworth strange situation, which is a psychological test you probably have seen, where you take a mother and a one-year-old into a room, then the mother leaves, what does the baby do?
Right.
Then you bring
right.
a stranger in.
Right.
What? That's the Ainsworth strange situation. We can predict from that at 1 year what your adult attachment style is going to be. So when I say that, what I mean is, are you going to be someone who is nice and normally attached, so no anxiety, so good solid attachments.
So when you say attachment, do you mean relationship?
I do.
Period?
I do.
You don't necessarily mean a partner attachment. You could just mean
all relating.
How you deal with human beings.
How you deal with human beings and the world.
And the world, yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
The objects, your objects. So in psychological speak, that's your people, but also your stuff, your things, your world. And so... so are you going to be have a nice secure attachment, or are you going to be anxiously attached? So there are three types of anxious attachment.
I'd probably suffer from all three, just so you know.
Well,
save you some time there.
So there's anxious attachment, there's insecure attachment, right? There's but there's also, you know, we can see the roots of psychopathology, the roots of madness even. In certain kinds of insecure attachment, right? So she can predict, Beatrice Beebe, from 230 frames between a mother and an infant, how that infant is going to relate as a one-year-old, and from there we can say how that infant is going to relate as an adult. That's pretty fascinating stuff.
It's incredible. And is the idea that this is just a study, or is the idea that then to hopefully shift behavior as a result of this?
It's
230
both.
Frames.
What's amazing is, so she's been doing this for 40 years.
Wow.
So
okay.
So there are 40 years of lab footage. So can I tell you how I came to make this
please.
Film?
Yeah, please. Yeah. Well, so, I mean, the implications, you know, I mean, all my listeners know about my incrementalism and little things making a big difference, and always, I don't try to contrive the interviews that I do, but there's always something.
Yeah.
There's always something there that you just go, holy smokes, this could change everything, right?
Well, that's how I feel about her work. Right? Because the first time I saw it, and what happened was I was at the Toronto Institute for Contemporary Psychoanalysis, and she was brought in as one of our special guest lecturers. She was giving a series of talks in Toronto that were just flat out sold out, huge auditoriums filled
with
people.
How old of a woman would she be?
She is a woman of a certain age.
A certain age, okay.
And she is absolutely beautiful, absolutely lovely, and just what you would expect from mm-hmm. someone who has been mm-hmm. playing with babies for
right.
all, her whole life.
Right.
But we had the privilege of having her come in and teach our small class the night before she was giving these massive lectures that she gives all around the world. And so I didn't know who she was at the time because I am not a psychologist. She is known, very, very well known in psychological circles, and a lot of my classmates at that institute were psychologists who knew of her work. I didn't. I was the last to arrive. Everyone was so intimidated by her that the seat beside her was the only one that was empty. Right? I didn't know who she was. I wasn't intimidated. I sat down beside her. And so for the rest of the evening, I was the baby, and she was the mother, so she needed a baby. So by the end, I had imprinted, basically. There was an imprint happening. We had bonded. And at the end of the evening, I also said, Beatrice, you know, I've been watching this video footage, and that, you know, for the last 40 years, you've been taking this footage, and, you know, the hairstyles are changing and the clothes are changing, but the mothers and the babies are staying the same, and it's really remarkable. And Beatrice is growing up in the footage
right,
too, because
right.
she's in she goes and plays with the baby after the mother plays with the baby and then shows the mother the footage. So I said, you just have to make a film. I mean, this has to be a documentary. You must make a documentary. And I make documentaries, I can tell you. And she said, okay. And
that was that easy.
That's how she is.
Wow. Not a whole lot of arm twisting going on.
No. And so we started working right away on a proposal. And we thought about different ways that we could do it and different
sure.
films we could make. Because she's been doing it for 40 years. She has longitudinal studies.
Wow.
So she knows what happens to the babies, right?
Right.
Also, she's working with 9/11, the widows of 9/11, and she's been working with the babies of 9/11. So the babies who were in utero when their fathers died in 9/11, Beatrice has been following since they were born, right? And working with them as an intervention, right? She has, it's not just Beatrice, she has a whole group of people. Beatrice has many people and many groups. So so making the film grew out of that, and then we saw that there was a video grant being offered through Psychoanalytic Electronic Publishing, which is the database in the world for psychoanalysis for journals, and they've started giving out video grants. So we applied for the grant, we got it, and
nice.
Then I took it to Q Media, and so I'm working on it there. So that's how the film sort of got started.
And that's going to be, is it a festival release? You going
no,
to
it's going to be on PepWeb. That's
oh, okay.
that's where it will be. And but we're making other films. I just made a DVD for her new picture book. She's putting out the mother-infant interaction picture book that was inspired by the work where she had hired an artist to do drawings, basically, to preserve the anonymity of the mothers.
Right.
And that's her, Phyllis Cohen, one of her colleagues, and Frank Lachman co-authored this book. It's coming out. W.W. Norton is putting this book out soon, so I just did the DVD for that book.
Neat.
We're working on a bunch of projects together. So, but it's all about this sort of like interaction between mother and infant.
What's remarkable is, I mean, I have no idea what the conclusions are and so on. I don't even know if you want to talk about that kind of stuff right now because of the film coming out, but 2.5 minutes.
Is a very little time,
it's
and yet...
It's ridiculous. It seems absurd.
So much information about... And so what we're focusing on in this film for PepWeb is actually kind of what we were talking about earlier about looking and eyes. And because the film is about looking and looking away. And it's very, very simple. Very, very simple. And this is also about how Beatrice's work is used as an intervention, right? It's not just research. It can also be used as an intervention. So when we're looking at each other, when human beings look at each other, as I said before, it's very stimulating. And we only look at each other for longer than 8 seconds or so when we're fighting or making love. That's how overstimulating it is. So when you have a mother and an infant playing together, right before the infant looks away, as an infant must, his heart rate is up, right? he's overstimulated and he needs to downregulate. So he looks away to downregulate. You see this. Hmm. When the baby looks away, what the mother does when the baby looks away is key. Does the mother wait for the baby to downregulate and come back, and does she then rejoin the baby? Or does the mother follow the baby? Does the mother somehow communicate to the baby, where did you go? Wait, what's wrong with me? Am I a bad mother? Are you rejecting me? Does the mother actually, some mothers, and it's very difficult to watch, will actually turn the baby's face back to them, which is really, really, as I say, it's difficult to watch because the baby never learns sort of how mm-hmm. to downregulate.
Right.
So when you think about people who can't kind of self-regulate,
yeah,
we can see the roots of it right there in how the baby and the mother are doing that rhythmic sort of dance, right? Is the mother anxious when the baby looks away, or is she okay? If she's okay, we have the roots of secure attachment. It's actually that simple.
It's that simple. Wow.
It's also not set in stone.
Right.
Which is the other really important thing to say.
Well, there has to be a lot of sort of externals and push-pull factors, and if it really is nature-nurture, I mean, there's a lot of other things that I would... variables.
Yeah, I mean, I think...
I would imagine.
One of the things is that you can do an intervention.
Right.
So Beatrice will actually, and she's taught other people to do this, she'll show people, mothers, the video, and she'll point out to them how wonderfully they're doing certain things.
Sure. Yep.
But then she'll also maybe say, you know, what were you feeling here? And the mother might say, well, when my baby looked away, I was feeling like maybe I wasn't entertaining the baby properly and that I have to entertain the baby all the time. And Beatrice will say, you know, you're actually doing great. You don't need to entertain the baby all the time, actually. And the baby, you know, the baby needs that. Here's what's happening. And that in itself can change the trajectory of a life, right there.
Wow.
That intervention.
That's incredible.
Yeah. I've interviewed mothers who will say that. For the film, I've interviewed mothers who say, that changed everything. I thought I had to entertain my baby constantly and sing to my baby and be there for my baby and provide what the baby needed right as the baby needed it.
Mm-mm. Right, right, right. Well, what's so fast, so just let me, if you don't mind, so Simone de Beauvoir and The Ethics of Ambiguity, and I talk about this fairly regularly because I think it's so essential to our understanding of who we are and how we relate to others, said that, you know, a man's unhappiness is first due to his having been a child, which I think is a quote of Descartes, actually. It's chapter 2, Ethics of Ambiguity. Wonderful phrase. But she talks about how we live under this umbrella of protection. Mm. Kind of oversimplification. Umbrella of protection, blame our parents, and then eventually we realize, holy smokes, you guys lied to us. Now what do I do?
Yeah.
And then we all of a sudden realize we have all this freedom. We don't know what the heck to do with it. So we react, we overreact, we overcompensate. We realize our attachment, I suppose, approach is maybe a little out of order or out of check. Mm. And then we overreact. And then she goes on to argue, you know, it's controversial for sure, but different types of people come out of this reaction, this, we don't want this freedom. But if it sounds to me, in a way, it's connected to this in a way, like the notion of self-regulation is let the baby do it on their own, right?
The baby has to learn.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And this is another, and it's great that Beatrice is a psychoanalyst as well, because psychoanalytic thinking knows, with all this infant research, neuroscience and psychoanalysis, we know so much now about the origins of, you know, the way that we are in the world, right? So, but what's so fascinating is when a baby is born, the baby doesn't know that there are other people, right? The baby doesn't have any idea when it's first born that anything exists outside of itself. And so it believes that it, and babies don't really think, right? Babies hallucinate. It's the sort of the proto-thinking. So babies will hallucinate the breast, let's say. So baby's hungry, I'm hungry, and all of a sudden food appears.
Right.
I made that happen. So,
right.
If that is not, so if everything the baby imagines is needed for itself appears exactly when it wants it, then the baby never learns to think.
Right.
Because the gap, because eventually that's not going to happen as soon as you want it, right?
Right. Right.
And so right. We need to be frustrated. It's called optimal frustration. We need to be frustrated to a certain extent for the beginnings of thinking, right? That's where thought starts. Oh, wait a minute. There's a world outside of me.
Right.
And then, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Which is kind of Beauvoir's point. And, you
exactly.
know, the phrase I love is thrown into a world not of our own making. And all of a sudden we realize that when, holy cow, now what?
Yes. So a child who's given too much nurturing, too much care, too much, I don't mean nurturing, I mean provided too much to just as they need it, is going to have a difficult time in the world because the world doesn't give you that. That's what Simone de Beauvoir is saying, right?
Yeah.
The world doesn't work like that. So when you have parents who really want to give their children perhaps what they didn't have, end up maybe giving their children, going the other way and giving their children too much, and then not providing their children with a sense of their own sort of agency.
Well, I joke all the time as a parent that I want to screw my kids up as little as possible. You know, the idea being that we're all going to, as parents, screw our kids up a little bit. You know, we're going
to,
you know, whatever. There's going to be issues. There's going to be things we'll transfer, you know, the fear of the dentist, you know, these kinds of things.
Transgenerational trauma.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, which we need to talk about by the sounds of it. Another documentary in the making, I understand.
Yeah,
that's right. You get around. So, but it seems to me that isn't the idea of being a good parent about allowing our kids to make the right choices, to choose appropriately, to mature. Isn't that maturity?
Well, I wouldn't even say
self-regulation, as you mentioned
earlier. Yeah, I wouldn't even say to make the right choices, just to make their
choices,
and to make mistakes,
and to
be okay with that. Because so many people who I see and hear are people who feel that they've made mistakes and they're not supposed to, right? Or who feel unhappy and they're not supposed to. Sometimes happiness is actually an appropriate response to certain events. But you see? So really, the phrase that Donald Winnicott used is, you know, good enough parenting. Mm. Good enough, right?
Right.
And again, so optimal frustration, good enough. These are things that we ought to sort of get into our minds.
Do you believe in happiness? I mean, you know, as a psychotherapist, or do you have another distinction?
Yeah, I think when you say happiness, you're using the capital H.
I guess so. I mean, you know, we talked about it earlier. You know, the mask, the happiness mask. The people that you meet are constantly up and so on. Fake it till you make it. Yeah,
that's the opposite of what I do in here.
Right.
I'm actually trying to ask people to find ways of thinking about themselves differently, right?
Right.
So the space in here is about creating that space where people can sort of view themselves from a different angle and allow things that get repressed or split off to kind of come back into the self so you can experience more of yourself.
Sure, sure.
Experiencing more of yourself, to me, it would be like as much of yourself as you can in the world is my definition of happiness.
Wow, interesting.
But I would not
But your true self.
Yes.
Which has got to be for most of us, especially for people of us who suffer from all types of anxious attachment, difficult to do. Isn't it hard to really, when you haven't been taught that appropriate self-regulation, as you call it, or the ability to deal with the outside world, or the ability to deal with those walls, or whatever it is, getting to the core. And I think this is where, you know, and Elizabeth will probably have some things to say if she listens to this podcast, but I think she has an ability to see herself in a way that I don't.
Mm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So I move towards books and, you know, what did Paul Simon say? Let my poetry and my books protect me, right?
Mm.
Boy, did I ever date myself there. But anyway, there's truth in that, right? That whole island approach, you know? I don't want to see myself. because I've been kind of taught or told by whoever, or
by the powers that be,
the powers
let's
that
say.
Be that yeah. I'm not worthy, right? I think.
Yeah.
And that's what you're trying to fight against in this room, is it not?
Yeah. Yeah, very often. Yeah, this idea, this voice that we end up in. And in a way, you know, it's kind of the superego. You
right.
know, there are different ways, again, there are different ways of talking about it. And each psychoanalytic sort of school has
yeah, sure.
a different, as you say, poetry
sure.
to try to put into words these things. But that is the other thing that I'm helping people to do, is to put things into words that maybe they never, ever have, right? And so the big thing in this room, aside from, as I said, free association, is the unconscious. Those are the two sort of pillars, right? Yeah.
Do you fall into a school?
Well,
You're
my
more of
training.
A postmodern?
No, I am absolutely not a postmodernist. I take issue. No, I would say that my training, because I did a master's at Sheffield in psychoanalytic studies, so that's British object relations. So, Klein, Winnicott, Beyond, these are thinkers that are really important to me. And then today, Adam Phillips, Christopher Bolas. These are the voices for me that are the most interesting in terms of thinking about psychoanalysis. But theory and technique are, you know, of course, you need to have a really good theory to have a very specific technique. But I'm still working on sort of what those will look like put together for me.
Is a good psychoanalyst or psychotherapist somebody who's been doing it for a long time, do you think? So just to talk
sometimes.
A little bit about that break.
Yeah,
sometimes.
The
theory,
yeah,
practical.
It's an art.
Yeah, I bet it is.
Psychoanalysis is above all an art.
Well, you're building relationships, right? But a very particular kind, it seems to me. Especially in this, I'm sitting in the patient's chair. If I was on the couch, I mean, that's a different relationship, I would imagine.
Yes, I mean, I think my own experience, because as an analytic candidate, I'm on the couch
right.
four times a week. Right? So I know that my analyst is a human being, person.
Yes, yeah.
But I don't experience her that way when I'm on the couch. I experience her in some ways more as a presence that is really a function that I will take in, that I take into my own mind.
So can you be friends with your analyst?
No.
You can't go
Absolutely.
In for a drink?
No.
You couldn't shoot a game of pool, go to see a film?
Absolutely not.
Okay, interesting. Because I've wondered sometimes, I mean, clearly therapy is, I think everybody can benefit from it.
I do too.
Absolutely, and I think we all need it. I really do, truly do.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that's not an admission of a liability, I don't think, or relational liability. I just think we could all benefit from this other tool in our toolbox.
For sure.
But sometimes I wonder if the world... and I mean the world collectively, had better friends, we might not need as much therapy. You know, if we had this ability to hold the 8-second glance, if we had the ability to go deep and to be soulful and to penetrate beyond just, you know, that scratching of the surface most of the time, we'd be wholer. And I mean that spelled W.
Wholer?
Yeah.
You
W-H.
Dream of a
is
world
that even a
where
word?
Therapy... So you dream of a world where therapy isn't necessary.
Almost, in
sure.
a sense. But it's not probably going to happen anytime soon, based on what I read and what I see in the news and so on. You know, it's just this, you know, this whole idea of a peace is possible, but you got to put your guns down first. And that's going to take a while, it seems to me, before we get there.
Yeah, I mean, you know... there is a very specific kind of listening that happens in analysis that's different from any kind of listening outside of this room. It's unique.
It's good.
So I do see what you're saying, that if we felt more, that we could be more forthcoming with the people in our lives. About
right.
the
transparency, authenticity. I think that's what I'm talking about, Karen, I think.
But something stops us. And so the thing that stops us is the thing that actually can happen here. Like the stop, you know, here is the thing that I'm trying to get rid of, right? Whatever that thing is.
Right.
So, and you can call it what you want, resistance, defense, you know, all of those things. The symptom, there are many ways of looking at it, but that's why we can't. That's why we don't. And we're afraid. We're afraid that, you know, that the people who love us won't love us anymore if the thing is spoken, the thing that we don't even know what it is, right?
Mm-hmm.
So putting that thing into words can, well, first of all, take the sting out of it, shine a light on it, and...
is it, so you know, fear is huge, right, obviously. I mean, talk about an understatement of the century. Mm-hmm. Is it fear of not being included? Is it fear of not being loved? Is it fear of not being embraced?
It,
you know, are most of us, is there a commonality, you know, is there a human racial connection here? Are we all racial in the sense of race, that we all share this deep desire to be loved, deep desire to be embraced, deep desire to be, yeah, come on in and join the party, kind of, if you know what
seen,
I mean, you know?
Seen, heard, understood.
Seen, heard, yeah, there you go.
Born in mind, okay, so like carried in another person's mind.
That we matter, that we exist,
that we are understood, that we are accepted.
Bridge of Spies.
Oh.
Okay, so it's a good film.
Okay.
A little slow at parts. Loved it. Absolutely loved it. And Tom Hanks' character, and I don't think I'm giving away too much here, but he gets sort of thrown into this situation of becoming a diplomat. He's a lawyer, and it's Cold War and so on. And a couple, I think three times throughout the film, basically he says, this guy's life matters.
Mm.
And it just really stood out to me. Mm. You know, this idea that, yeah, okay, maybe he's a criminal, maybe he's a traitor, maybe he is a spy and a communist and all of those things, which would have been pretty horrible to be back in the 50s and early 60s. And yet for Hanks's character, this guy matters still.
Mm.
That's pretty cool. That's pretty amazing, right?
Yes, that a human life.
Yeah, and I think it might even be, the phrase might even be human beings matter or something. But but the way it comes out, it just, for me, it was like a bell going off.
Mm.
But it's definitely a subtext of the film for sure.
It's wonderful when those moments happen for us, the bell moments.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sadly, we're going to have to wrap this up soon, I think, and we're going to have to do part two. I hope we can. Can you tell me a little bit about this other film that you're working on? Because it sounds fascinating, but this idea of transgenerational trauma. I mean, I know to say that we're about to end and then ask you about transgenerational trauma is absurd.
I'll try to say it really quickly. Well, I mean, the idea that we inherit things from our parents, our elders, that were sort of unmetabolized in them, right? So stuff that was overwhelming, traumatizing in the generation before makes its way through many, many different ways into our consciousnesses and unconsciousnesses. So what I'm looking at specifically in the film that I'd like to make that I'm developing is about transgenerational trauma in China.
Hmm.
People who are now suffering from the after effects of the Cultural Revolution and the horrors of the Cultural Revolution and the Great Leap Forward, and the generation now that doesn't even know why it suffers in the way that it does. And what I'm looking at is the psychoanalysts in Germany, in Norway and Denmark, and in Canada who are helping people, psychoanalysts, basically, the new psychoanalytic movement in China, deal with transgenerational trauma. The Germans specifically know how to do this really well, because they've got lots of transgenerational trauma. Some even would say that the concentration camps are an answer to the deprivations that happened before, World War I, like the starvation that happened in Germany gets played out by starving all of these people. So this is the unconscious, right?
I see.
This is how transgenerational trauma can enact in the next generation. It can be acted out. And so what we're now trying to think about is how these traumas are passed down and how they can then be actually sort of digested and processed and moved through and released. The mental hospitals, psychiatric hospitals in China are filled with people who see posters of Mao everywhere and think that, you know, it's being expressed in this
way. So would I be one of those? So I was born in 65. Mm-hmm. So would my parents have passed on some of that to me had I been Chinese? So in other words,
well, you would have been born in the Cultural Revolution.
Right in the middle of the revolution.
Cultural Revolution is...
Or would it be my kids you'd be looking at more? Or both?
Both. Yes. In the Cultural Revolution, you denounced people and they went and got murdered. You as a teenager at the time, or your parents even, might have been Red Guard, you know, siblings.
Sure.
And they would have maybe murdered some people. They would have maybe been persecuted themselves. And it's then later you have to live with those people who survived and the people you bullied and the people who bullied you. Often you did both, bullied and were, you know.
It's fascinating. For me, so I'm hoping to do a PhD in philosophy. I'm actually submitting an application really soon.
That is so cool.
Ethics and international development would be collaborative. And what I'm going to focus on is the issue of trust. And so most people wind up in Rome, but all roads for me lead back to Cambodia. Mm-hmm. And so, as most of my listeners will know, and so this issue of trust in Cambodia deeply goes, I mean, it just resonates on so many different levels. And I would imagine there's some similar, very similar things going on with this idea of transgenerational trauma.
Absolutely.
You know, we've got a culture, I mean, in the Khmer Rouge in the mm-hmm. 70s and... I think the connections are really interesting. But for you, is it about trust? So you've got these people who have, you know, maybe led to other people dying. You've had people, you know, the indoctrination, the camps, etc. I mean, isn't it really a breakdown of that? I was going to say veneer, but it's not a veneer. I mean, you hope it goes a little deeper than that.
I think it's trust that my story or experience is going to be held and heard. So this is the idea behind Truth and Reconciliation Commissions.
It's, right, which a lot of people don't agree with, right, and don't see the value in.
But I certainly do, because again, and everything we've really been talking about today is about kind of story.
It is,
right?
Yeah, and that's, which is so amazing to me.
When I say that things are of a piece for me, documentary, psychoanalysis, therapy, all of this, it's all about story. And so in a place like Cambodia, in a place like China, people need to tell their story. They need to speak the thing that was unspeakable. And they need to be heard, and they need to know that they are heard, and they need to hear themselves, too. And I think it's crucial. That's what people need to know, that their experience is, you know...
We're back to kind of mattering, aren't we?
Yes.
In a way?
Yes, that they matter.
That they matter, that their story matters, that this wasn't all for naught, as my father would say, you know?
Yeah.
Wow, incredible stuff. Thanks so much for joining us today. I hate to end it there, but I mean, it feels like we're just starting. I mean, I so often will say with my guests that I feel like we're just scratching the surface, and we truly are. And I think part two, I'm taking your chair. And you can have this chair, and we'll see if there's a
usually I'm the one who says, okay, we have to stop
now. that's right. Thank you so much, Karen Doherty. .ca, check out Karen's practice online. I'm sure there's other info there as well. Film coming out soon,
in the spring.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be on the PEP Web Network, is that?
PEP Web website, yes. It's a database, and yes.
Amazing. Well, all the best with all the work you have coming up. And again, thanks for being a guest today on the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.